My name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
In today's episode, we speak to Carolina from Charity Entrepreneurship about the animal charities they want to incubate in the next program, which starts in February 2024, what the benefit of joining their charity incubator is, as well as how they select which charities to incubate. And if you've ever considered launching a charity to help animals, then this is definitely the podcast for you. Likewise, if you know someone who's toyed with that possibility, please do share it with them. On another note, we've been having technical issues with our recording software, so my audio quality isn't particularly good this episode, so I apologize for that. We're changing our software providers, so hopefully we shouldn't have this issue again. But without further ado, here is the episode. Hi everyone, today we're joined by Carolina Sadek, co-founder and co-executive director of Charity Entrepreneurship, an organization that provides training and funding for launching new impact-focused nonprofits, including animal advocacy. Carolina is also a fund manager in the Effective Altruism Animal Welfare Fund and an advisor for multiple impact-focused NGOs. Welcome, Carolina.
Thanks so much, James. Thanks, Amy. As I mentioned, I listened to all the episodes of the podcast, so very happy to be here with you here today.
Thank you. Our biggest fan so far, potentially. So thanks for coming on. So a question we'd like to start everyone off with is, what's a view you hold that most animal advocates would disagree with?
Yeah, I absolutely love this question. And I guess maybe my answer would be something along the lines of like, sometimes I see like a lot of optimism that we're going to fix factory farming, we're going to completely end this practice, and that's, you know, this change is just behind the corner and, you know, we're going to see it in our lifetime. And unfortunately, I do believe that, you know, in the future, we might live in 1,000 years from now. We maybe solve issues of global health. We eliminated global poverty. We solve all problems that humans are facing, and everyone is living happy and fulfilling lives. And yet we still have factory farming, maybe at a larger scale than we've ever had because the population is growing as well. So it might sound like a very tragic way to start an episode focused on helping animals, but here's the thing. I do think it's very feasible to address, and this is an issue that we can solve. Not sure it's going to happen within our lifetime. Maybe it will take our children or grandchildren to see that massive change globally. But I think it's important to have a good sense of that view is that it might determine what sort of interventions we prioritize, or even how we think about solving this problem. So I do think currently, every new person and every new organization working on this issue is absolutely crucial and have a real chance of having a very enormous impact on farm animals alive now and in the future, and just basically in the light of magnitude of the problem and how, I guess, meaningful changing it would be. I think we need a lot of people working on the movement and a lot of organizations contributing to solving that. Because again, it might not happen by itself. It won't, most likely won't happen by itself. And I think that only speaks to the importance of the work that everyone is doing in the movement and that every person matters here.
That's really interesting. I feel like, kind of a more like long-term focus as well in terms of not, the kind of future trajectory of what the movement could look like as well, and thinking about, I know we talk a lot about impact and effectiveness, and I'm not always sure that we have like a combined sense of what those terms mean. So I feel like thinking at it in this angle and thinking, like you said, that every effort, you know, contributing to perhaps years and years in the future of change, I think is an interesting perspective.
Yeah. And sometimes when people think about the long term of farm animal welfare, if they assume very short timeline for abolishing factory farming, that might push them toward, okay, it's just behind the corner. Let's push for the biggest and largest change we can have right now. Or on the other hand, it can push them toward, oh, we need a lot of diversity of approaches. Let's write a lot of things, because if the impact is only in the future, therefore it will take a while for us to get there. Therefore, maybe the results in near term don't matter as much. We should be just thinking in the long term. And I think in a way, both of those views might be slightly misguided and often thinking kind of like in all or nothing type perspective would lead us astray here. And I think even if you think about long-term impact, you can be thinking what could be small changes we could be doing right now that we have very strong track record of, that have lots of evidence that are effective, and all of this that will push us toward that timeline in the future. And I think sometimes that kind of this walking this middle path might be where we could be looking for different solutions.
Yeah, so interesting.
What are the main reasons you think you're so pessimistic, or like you think it's so much less likely to be solved in the next like 1,000 years versus other issues?
Yeah, I guess not sure whether you've read a book by Steven Pinker on Enlightenment Now. He basically made a thesis that put up the thesis that all human problems are going down over time. You know, we have less global conflict over time. We have, you know, human health is improving, humans' well-being is improving, all of those sort of things. And he really backs it with evidence. And he almost shows progress on every aspect of human life. And he very sneakily skipped the chapter on factory farming, because I think this is one of the problems that is actually not getting better globally as kind of humanity progress forwards. And we, of course, we can see it in, on the one hand, we see the evidence in, you know, particularly in the European Union, when we look at legislative changes and policy changes, yes, in policy, in law, in Europe, or even in the United States, we have better laws for animals and factory farm animals than we ever had in the past. However, when you take a global perspective and just look at the number of animals, farmed animals, farmed at any point, we see this kind of like graph increasing. So when we see kind of like graph going down for mortality, human mortality, graph going line going down for human conflict, we see line going up for numbers of factory farmed animals. So in a way, currently the trajectory is still in terms of numbers of animals upwards as the population grows. So kind of we see kind of reverse trend in number of animals that are on factory farms. And I think we have been making really, really meaningful progress in many parts of the world. But in other parts of the world, the problem is still we are not making as much traction as we really would hope if we do want to solve this issue in our lifetime.
Well, maybe one, I think, interesting analogy is, we don't have to dwell on this too long, but it's, I guess, the climate movement is a similar, I think, example. Mm. Although you might say, you might look like, if you just take a very high level view of like carbon emissions put out in the atmosphere every year, it's actually still going up and up and up. And so in many ways, you'd say like the problem's getting worse. But actually, I think if you ask most people in the climate movement, how do you feel like things are going? And they'd say, actually, I think things are improving, because like the capacity to do stuff has grown massively because the movement has grown and there's a many more people involved. But maybe there's some kind of like delayed response between the capacity of the movement and like the results they achieve. So I wonder if that'd be the same for us in terms of, even the EU, things are getting, like, numbers are still going up, but maybe there's some delayed response of like, could even be like a decade of like our strength and corresponding drops in animal numbers.
Yeah, I guess then it's interesting to acknowledge your co-founding of Charity Entrepreneurship, and I assume has quite a lot of a basis of those important kind of crucial questions towards solving this issue with one of your course areas focus being farmed animals and animal advocacy work. So I'm interested in your personal journey, Carolina, to this point, how you ended up co-founding Charity Entrepreneurship. And then, perhaps we can also touch on your fund management of the Effective Altruism Animal Welfare Fund.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I feel in a way my journey started when I was still a kid, in a way. Maybe I wasn't a typical puppy-loving, video-watching of cute cats kind of kid, but I definitely cared about animals a lot when I was younger. You know, I had empathy for them, all of them. And even my mom recently told me a story that I used to ask those like really weird questions like, hey, mom, imagine you're walking like in the middle of the road and on the left side, you have a human lying down on the sidewalk and, you know, clearly needing your help. And of course, you want to help them because they need your help. But on the right side, you have a horse lying down on the other side of the sidewalk. I didn't know about factory farming issue at the time. And, you know, it also clearly needs your help. It's injured and kind of, you know, what do you do in this situation? And of course, my mom, as like a normal person, would answer, I would run and help a human and with their injury. But to me, it was, but mom, look, everyone is going to think like you're thinking and going to help a human, and horse going to be left there alone. And to me, kind of like when my mom told me the story, it's like, that's crazy. That just sounds like a consideration of like, I don't know, neglectedness of an issue or something at a very early age.
How old are you at this point?
I don't know. I have no idea. My mom said like primary school or something like this.
Also, the classic utilitarian trolley experiment, right? That's just like
a little bit. Exactly. So it seemed I cared about animals from a very early young age, but I didn't go vegan until I was like 17, 18. you know, immediately after I moved to a bigger city to study, and one of the very first thing I was doing is looking for opportunities to contribute to farm animal welfare issues more than just my diet. So at the time I came across Open Cages, and now also in the broader umbrella of Animal International. Now they're a very big organization, but at the time they were very, very young. I don't know how long they've been running, but they didn't have any paid staff, very volunteer run. A young organization. And that was very formative time for me. You know, I volunteered at a local group. I started coordinating parts of their campaign work, very early campaign work, pre-corporate campaigns. Later also continue with like doing research and evaluation for them. And that's about the time when I read Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. But it wasn't actually that book that made me commit to farming oil for issues. It was his other book called The Life You Can Save, because that really made the kind of like moral case why it's so important and seem feasible to focus on solving those problems, and that you can use your life to address it and not just have that as a, you know, side gig or a side hobby outside of your work. So that really made me commit to the issues full time and wanted to dedicate my life to it. And I guess that led me to think about effective altruism more broadly. I co-founded Polish Foundation for Effective Altruism, where I would work with existing organizations to try to improve their impact. So what I would do is conduct research and prioritization research, then later on come back to the organization to help them either implement or start a new effective program or replace the old programs with the new one that's going to be much more effective. And in principle, that sounds great because, you know, the organizations were very large scale. The demand seemed to be very large. They were very keen to work with me and with us as an organization and change their programs to much more effective. So on the one hand, that was like very, very big learning experience, I would say, just because even the fact that demand there exists for improving the effectiveness of your work, it doesn't mean that change will actually happen. And I found that kind of like, yeah, very good learning experience where implementing change at this large scale was actually much harder than I or even the person interested in doing this expected. So it didn't end up having any significant impact, I would say, outside of that being very shaping on my thinking as well. And that's about the time when I met Joey, who I co-founded Charity Entrepreneurship with, and we kind of like spent it countless hours debating whether it's better to, you know, improve effectiveness of existing organizations, or it might be better to conduct research on what is the highest impact thing to do, and then start from scratch, start new organizations. As you can tell from my history, the starting new organization won the debate. So I packed my bags, flew to Canada, where Joey was at the time, where we had a little bit of instructor to start CE.
You grew up in Poland, right? So you were in Poland up until then, until like what age was this until you moved to Canada?
I think I was around 22, I think something like this. Yeah. So I was at the Poland then. I was still studying at my fifth year of my studies. We had like a combined master's in Poland. So it was my last year of my study, and I did have to drop out from my uni to start CE. My university was not accommodating at all, but I just believed in what CE could do. I saw the pressing need for new organizations working on those issues and tackling those problems.
Nice. Wow. It's very inspiring. At 22, not bad.
Yeah, it's very bold. I'm not sure I know of many other 22-year-olds sort of outside of the Charity Entrepreneurship Program, I guess, who would pack bags and move across the world. I guess it's interesting to me that you talk about your mother like telling you stories of you already having this kind of sense of prioritization in your mind from a young age. Do you feel like that was influenced by them? Like I have a 7-year-old daughter myself, and I feel like sometimes she comes out with things that I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely influenced by conversations that my partner and I have had. Where do you think that came from?
Yeah, I think I did not think that it was influenced by them. But then the more I thought about that, then the more I've seen connections. Like my dad would always, like from very, you know, kindergarten age, would teach me that every animal matters. Like he's not vegan or anything like this, but, you know, he literally won't hurt a fly. And he would always, you know, explain to me, you have to take this fly. If you don't want a fly or a spider in your house, take it outside, put it in the grass. Really showed like consideration for like, and individual animals, even if they belong to a group that people don't usually feel empathy for, like insects. And I think that sort of showing compassion toward them have been very like like informative for me as well. And I think that's probably how I started thinking about animals as individual beings, that all of them matter regardless of the species and all of those sort of things.
Okay, cool. And how did you end up on the EA Animal Welfare Fund after being involved with Charity Entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so the very first year of CE, we focused on farm animal welfare issues. That was the very first cause area we tackled. And so we spent countless number of hours researching animal welfare issues, figuring out how to measure and compare welfare of animals in different conditions. You know, what are the largest problems? What countries are the most important? What is the evidence behind given tactic or behind given improvement in welfare we could be making? Just like that was my life at the time. And I think maybe just like, you know, I cared about impact. I thought a lot about how to prioritize between different actions for farming welfare. And maybe that was noticed. And I was invited to join the EA Animal Welfare Fund as a fund manager at the time. So it's been 5 years since I co-founded Charity Entrepreneurship and about 4 years on the fund as well. So quite a while.
In terms of Charity Entrepreneurship, what's like the headline of, if you had to give the classic 1 minute elevator pitch to describe CE, how would you do that?
Yeah, I guess it might come back to this kind of the life you can save. There's trillions of animals suffering in factory farms. There's millions of humans dying and suffering from preventable diseases, despite thousands of NGOs existing. And I guess like the tagline says that we are launching high impact charities. And with that kind of crucial part of high impact, we want to create nonprofits that would be one of the most effective in the world. And in tackling those problems. And I think that's kind of really what it comes down to, because we can have that impact and because a lot of people can, and it matters.
Yeah, of course. And you work across multiple cause areas, right?
Yeah, it's one, but very meaningful part. So we have some cause areas that we only worked on once. We have some cause areas that we will continue working toward until we solve them, I guess. And I think kind of farm animal welfare is one of those. And broadly, global health and development is another one of those. Those are kind of like, we almost have them every year as a main focus. And other ones are we just adding for as an experiment for 1 year, see how it's going and all of those things. But I think farm animal welfare work is crucial part and integral part to what we do.
Mm. Yeah.
And what are some examples of charities you've launched that people might be aware of or can look up if they're interested?
Yeah, a couple of comes to mind. The very first one was Fish Welfare Initiative. They're working on improving farmed fish welfare, and particularly in India. They also have some global campaigns as well, but their main focus is in India, since it's one of the largest producers of fish globally. That same year, we also launched Animal Advocacy Careers. They're helping animal activists find careers in an animal advocacy space more broadly. Shrimp Welfare Project is another one. Health Your Hands is another one. They're working on feed fortification to prevent needle bone fractures, one of the largest source of suffering for egg-laying hens. Animal Ask is another one. They're working for organizations to find the most impactful interventions or campaigns organization could be implementing and doing and help organization make decisions, just because the impact between, you know, the choice of idea or choice for campaign could be have a very meaningful influence on the overall impact of the organization. And lastly, some organization we incubated last cohort is Animal Policy International. They're working on banning low welfare imports, right now focusing on New Zealand, but might scale up globally after a win in that country.
Nice. So that's like six. Yeah, I think pretty, I would say some of them are
a
definitely
lot,
like...
Quite a lot, and growing, and
yeah,
growing.
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah, yeah. So I think it's been like two a year, right? And the way that program works and context. Yeah, I went through it in 2021. So there's some rounds that focus a lot more on some issues and some that don't. So you'll have some animal focus rounds and some not. Is that broadly correct?
Yeah, I would say that's roughly correct. We try to have like animal heavy cohorts and human heavy cohorts, so-called, just because it's easier. Very integral part of the incubation program is finding a co-founder, just because starting an organization by yourself is challenging. Starting an organization by itself is challenging, not even talking about starting alone. So we kind of like really recommend having a co-founder, and part of the incubation program is helping you find a co-founder for your organization.
such an interesting process, I think, especially within the movement, as you were saying before, a lot of organizations starting kind of at grassroots level, been around for a while. And so I think, yeah, thinking, going through your process, thinking of these interventions, I didn't actually do the program myself, but was really fortunate to co-found Animal Ask with George, who did do the program multiple times, I think, actually, to work through and find something that was a good match for his skill set.
So what are the charities you're recommending for the next animal program, and actually animal heavy program, and when will that program be as well?
Sure. So we'll have three ideas we're recommending for new organizations. First one is focusing on fish welfare for corporate campaigns and policy work in Greece, also aiming to influence standards in the at the EU level. So the very short description of this, basically, Greece is the largest fish producer in the European Union and the 15th largest producer in the world, but literally no one is working or planning to work on fish welfare there. And the headline goal of the charity should likely be policy change, but corporate campaigns might be a useful first tool to build public and corporate support for the policy, similar as it was done for Cage Free as well. And basically ensuring that fish welfare legislation in Greece would not only impact 440 million fish farmed in the country, but also giving strategic importance of Greece in the upcoming in the EU. We also hope that by having largest producer in Europe leading the way on fish farming, that will also make it easier to pass legislations on the EU level as well. So we can kind of like broader implications of this work as well. So it's not just fish welfare in Greece, it's very strategically important on for the work on fish welfare on the EU level as well. So that's the first organization.
Just to clarify on that one, so you're perhaps looking for people who are already based in Greece or would be willing to move there. Is that kind of an integral part of the co-founder living situation, that they would obviously be able to work and move and work in that region?
Yeah, definitely ability to work in Greece and visit Greece quite a lot is important. You don't have to be from Greece. You don't have to live there. You don't have to move there. To start those organizations, we had organizations being started by people who are not from those countries, and that haven't been a barrier for them.
Well, that sounds kind of surprising. How would you possibly do Greek policy without speaking Greek or being Greek, right?
Oh, absolutely. You do need your staff to speak Greek and be able to work in policy. But you as a co-founder, you don't have to. Again, most likely your role will be running organization, managing people, you know, making strategic, shaping strategic direction of the organization. It wasn't necessarily, you won't be necessarily the person who goes in and talk with policymakers. You'll have to have hire staff for it. And we believe that you can hire staff for it who are based in Greece as well.
That makes sense.
So the second organization is working on issues of insect farming. So something I already mentioned before, insect farming is a rapidly growing industry. Around tens of billions of insects are alive at farms at any point in time, primarily being farmed as feed to other animals. And there's just so many misconceptions about in the industry. Insect farming is, you know, often taught as a being sustainable solution to factory farming, but there are many key questions and uncertainties regarding sustainability, environmental impacts, food safety concerns, animal welfare issues, of course. And we aim to work with relevant stakeholders like investors, policymakers, entrepreneurs, and insect farmers to tackle those problems and really kind of really affect growth of the industry.
Mm.
Great.
And this would be kind of like based anywhere or like with a particular focus or like to be decided?
Yeah, most likely this will be global. Most likely organization will have the global focus. Whether that will be particularly focused on policymakers or investors, that might be determined by the co-founder fit as well. We think that both of those approaches are impactful and feasible, and it might be come down to like co-founder fit to which approach they will take. But given how insect farming industry currently operates and is likely to operate, this organization will likely have like a more global scope with particular focus whenever opportunity arises.
Makes sense.
And the very last organization, there's a third one, and this one is about bringing organization focused on bringing new contractual funding into animal advocacy movement. So we spoke a little bit about that funding is often a key bottleneck for animal advocacy movement going forward. And we didn't want the funding to be something that limits effective work for animals. And, you know, there's so much more work that can be done if there's more funding available for them. And often funders themselves say that we wish we had more funding we could spend. There are opportunities we want to see being funded. We just don't have enough funding for that. So a new organization would be focusing on bringing new funding and closing those funding gaps as well. So that could be anything from promoting on large scale, giving pledges, like giving what we can, targeting at vegans, or it could be outreach to high net worth individuals, maybe in countries like India or USA, as we identify as kind of promising places to start. But again, similar to the previous idea, what approach we decide to go with might depend on the type of founder that will apply.
That's very cool. Yeah, I think it's a very nice spread of three ideas because they kind of range from being quite meta, like good for the whole movement, people who are like having that overview, to something that's like very focused on, let's say, policy or neglected species in a certain country, in this case, fish welfare in Greece, to something that's kind of like limiting and preventing the growth of the insect industry, which also could have knock-ons for other industries like fish welfare, because often insects are grown to be fed on fish. So yeah, I think it's quite cool, like range of opportunities, and hopefully people have, I think, different tastes, so to speak, in the kind of work they want to do. And hopefully there's something that kind of fits everyone's kind of motivations and skill set in this range.
Exactly.
And how can people apply to the program for this cohort?
Sure. So the next cohort is in February, March 2024, and applications are open right now. The deadline is September 30th. So you have a little bit of time, a little bit more than a month to apply to the program to join the next cohort.
Yeah, great. We can link the application in the show notes for anyone interested in applying.
Let's say I'm someone who's listening to this podcast. I think, wow, this is so great. What would be the benefit for me for actually taking part in the charity entrepreneurship program? So what would I get? How would I be supported to start a nonprofit versus me trying to do it outside of the program on my own?
Yeah, definitely. No, I do think if you're the sort of person who wants to start something, there's still... We heard from people, there's so many barriers for starting your organization. Anything from, I don't have a team to do it with, or I don't know how to even raise funding for something like this, or this is the first time I'm doing this. I have no idea how to start. And not even talking about the uncertainty and the stresses of it and all of that comes with it. And sometimes even the self-perception, I am not good enough, or I'm not that sort of person. I'm not the extroverted, high confidence, you know, charity like or startup founder you see on stages, you know, making a pitch or something like this. There's just like so many barriers about that. And when starting CE, we basically try to assess all of the barriers that exist and then address them one by one. So it's not, as I mentioned, it's not just an incubation program. So one of the main concerns is for people is I don't have a good idea. I think I'm a good fit personally, but I don't have a good idea for a new charity. So we have a whole research team dedicated to finding the most high impact ideas and recommending them for founders. Another concern is I don't have a co-founder. I don't have a team to start with, and I don't think I can do it by myself. We have during the program, we support co-founder matching. We already get to the cohort, very talented, very dedicated people. And then throughout the program, we help you find among them the person who will be best fit for you as a co-founder to start an organization with. We provide training, all the basics in starting and launching and running effective organizations. We provide training and education about those sort of things as well. And I think the kind of like part that often people think is the most important at the beginning is the funding, because at the end of the incubation program, people prepare project proposals. Those are the ideas for their organizations with their co-founder team, with their idea pairing, with their plan that they've developed throughout the 2 months incubation program. They prepared a project proposal. And with this, we have Seed Funding Network. This is a network of funders and individuals and representative of foundations that want to fund early stage initiatives. And within a week from submitting proposal, you have an answer whether you got funding for your organization. And the success rate of funding is about 80%. So it's really, really high. If you are in the cohort, if you're submitting proposal, there's a very high chance you're going to get funded.
And the funding ranges for about like a year runway, right? It's like, what is the expected funding?
So the range is wide. At the beginning, first year, it was like about 50K. Now it's closer. I think the highest one was $100,000. So this is broadly the range. I would say majority of them are in the kind of like 100 something amount, as that should be enough to cover the funding for our organization for a year, for them to fundraise for the future years as well. So funding is like a part of that process as well. But I think the most important part is the kind of like mentorship, long-term mentorship and the community of people. So you have the whole community of people who've done something like this, who were in a similar situation as you were, who are supportive of each other and helping each other out. And I think that's kind of like a very meaningful part of the process. So when you ask people about what they found, what they thought is going to be most important factor for them, they said seed funding. Of course, that's the most important. That's what I'm missing. But when we survey them at the end of the program, what you actually found most helpful, they often say is the confidence that it gave me, the kind of the sense that I can do it. Yes, I, person who just graduated from unrelated degree, can do it and can have very meaningful impact on animals. And I think that's often what people say, and the long-term support and community and mentorship that comes with it is very important part of that as well. Without it, I don't think it would be the organization would be us making as much progress as they are making. So
yeah, I think we can both attest to the kind of warmth and support we felt from the community even now, and I imagine, you know, many years into the future, kind of in a way how James and I have connected and essentially started this podcast, like having that thread of connection through charity entrepreneurship. So yeah, we can both definitely agree there.
As someone who took part in the program, I think, yeah, I thought one of the most helpful things would be the tangible templates on budgeting and hiring, which I do still use today 2 years later, which is very helpful. But actually, I think it's what you said, Carolina, which is, I mean, the community of people, this is incredibly helpful and supportive. And whenever I have basically any problem that I can't fix myself, I'll turn to people I met through the Charity Entrepreneurship Program and say, hey, you guys are a couple years ahead of me. How did you solve this hiring problem or this, you know, boring tax and legal problem or whatever? And almost always I'll be helped with something incredibly useful and people giving so much time. So yeah, I think that network has still been such a resource, and I think, yeah, so valuable. So I think that alone makes it worth it for anyone to take part. So yeah, I would say highly recommend.
Yeah, so glad to hear that, James. So glad to hear that. And then we do try to facilitate that. Of course, that just happened by itself, just by, you know, the virtue of people being helpful. But we also try to facilitate it, the kind of cross year, also cross learning. There's a lot of that farm animal movement can learn from other movements. There's other movements that can learn a lot from farm animal welfare. And just like the fact that you can learn from such a diverse group of organizations in different contexts, often facing the same problems in very different contexts, sometimes facing very specific problems that actually turns out that someone from cohort from 3 years ago from a completely different cause actually faced and solved. It's just invaluable. And I think I agree with you that it's big part of that.
And in terms of bottlenecks to starting charities, what are the main ones you think in your mind that stops more amazing charities being started or founded?
Yeah, it's very much the finding the co-founders for charities. We have the funding, we have the ideas, we have the support. It's really finding the people who are ready to jump in and give it a fair shot. And I think I really want to encourage more people. You know, it's very hard for you to think of self, I am the sort of person who will start the next most effective organization. That's just like very daunting thing to think about. But again, you're not doing it alone. And I think we do need more co-founders. And I think that's the biggest bottleneck for starting more effective organizations and for the most organizations existing in the world. So if you're the sort of person who cares about impact and really want to have the largest impact on animals you can, I really want to encourage you to think whether that might be an option for you. And, you know, at the beginning, you're just committing to applying.
I personally found the process quite fun as well. I think, well, there's like 5 stages, so it's a bit of a process, but I think it's like, it's interesting because like, oh, let me apply my thinking to this problem I've never thought about. It's actually quite fun. Maybe this would be a good fit for me. So you also learn about yourself. Yeah. Like, would you enjoy this? And yeah.
And what's your kind of best case co-founder? What is it that you're looking for?
I would say that there's no like best co-founder. Best co-founder is not like any particular person. They can be a recent graduate like Haven from Fresh Welfare Initiative or successful business manager like Andres from Shim Welfare Project. What really makes them successful is like not their education. It's not their background. It's not their, you know, success they had in the previous job. But really what makes them be unique is kind of like how altruistic they are, how committed to having an impact, and how laser focused they are on having an impact. And I think that's like the very most important kind of being ambitiously altruistic, exceptionally hungry for having that high impact is a very core thing we're looking for in people. You know, being conscientious, someone who is have a strong sense of duty, who proactively plans, takes action, keep tracks of tasks without, you know, following up and all of those sort of things, just really get things done. You know, someone who is resilient and energetic and self-driven, I think that's like super important as well. You know, you will be operating in a space with a lot of uncertainty. You will be operating in a space that is sometimes hard to work with, and having that, you know, this resilience and being able to bounce back after if someone doesn't go that something doesn't go well is very important. So I think that's kind of quite important, you know, being productive learner and having growth mindset. That's very important as well, because again, you won't know everything. Most likely will know very little about, you know, starting in a running effective organization. So you will have to learn and you will have to learn fast. So that's important as well. And lastly, kind of being result oriented, creative, you know, sometimes, you know, best solution is completely out of the box, and having the sort of mind that can think of that sort of thing as well. But saying all of those things, I don't think you have to have it all. You won't have it all. It's just like not possible. It's very like low probability that you will have all of those things, and you don't have to. You know, that's what co-founding team is for. That's what your advisors are for. That's what your staffs are for.
And within the program, what are you needing the co-founders to kind of commit to in terms of time scale? And there's like trainings and meetings with mentors, and how much of a kind of all-in commitment is this for those individuals that join the incubation program?
So I guess there are different stages, right? To join the incubation program, the commitment is, you know, I'm going to spend full time for 2 months learning and giving it a shot, basically. We provide financial stipends. That's another, I guess, benefit we give for ways to reduce barriers. We provide financial stipends to cover the cost of living during the incubation program, but also after the incubation program, if you do not get a seed grant. So kind of like support people with financially throughout that as well. So really what you're committing at the very beginning is, I'm just going to give this program a shot. I'm going to spend full time of 2 months of my months seeing whether that's is shaping up for me. And that's the commitment we're asking for. After you start organization, of course, that's 100% different. Of course, it doesn't make sense to start something and then leave after 3 months. That's probably not very efficient, or it's probably too hard to run and or start and run organization if you're just part-time on it. That's just not very feasible. So after you start, we do really hope you're going to commit to it, you know, for at least a year. Most likely co-founders stay for much longer than that, of course. But that's kind of like the minimum level of commitment we're expecting. So it's really up to you how much you'll be using that support.
Yeah. So I'm interested in what the process is for deciding which organizations to start, the criteria that you use, and how you're kind of assessing and deciding what are those really important interventions to start right now.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I guess something that's maybe worth mentioning to people who don't have like a background and knowledge about charity entrepreneurship is that we're not just incubation program. We are also a research organization. So kind of like recommending idea for new organizations is very important part of what we do. So we have a whole research team dedicated to researching the most effective interventions to help animals as well as humans in other cause areas as well. So we have a whole team working just on researching new ideas for organizations. And I guess what the team is looking for, we broadly start with like a very long list, like, you know, 400 ideas for new organizations. It's a lot of brainstorming, a lot of pulling from other organizations, talking with experts, all of those things to create this initial list. And then very, very slowly throughout the year, they work down the list, researching less and less ideas in more depth. And broadly what they are looking for ideas that tackle, you know, in general, have the chance to become one of the most effective organizations in the world. So the most impactful ideas for new organizations. And often what it might come down to is, you know, does this idea address a large scale problem? Is this problem neglected? Does it mean that it's going to be, is it addressed by someone else, or will it be solved anytime soon, or it doesn't look like that it's on the trajectory to be solved? Is how much evidence there is of effectiveness or a track record behind this intervention? Are there any limiting factors that could limit the impact of those organizations? Like, for example, okay, we might want to start organizations working on insect welfare in the Philippines. How many people will likely want to work on this in the Philippines? Probably not as much. Maybe then it's better to start somewhere else or maybe focus a different issue, because there are sometimes when you think about existing organizations, you can, or if you're thinking from perspective of like a existing organization, you might be thinking, okay, I have the, I had I have people, I have funding, I have everything I need, than what I want to implement. And when we think about starting new organizations, we often also have to think about those limiting factors. Like, is there enough talent that could be working on those issues? Especially if we end up working on issues that are quite neglected, right? Like issue of shrimps or fish. Those are not the very first one that comes to mind when thinking about helping animals. So we have to kind of think about those limiting factors. Is there anything that will stop the organization before they will hit that impact? So that's something we think about as well.
Between the rounds, is there like, you're saying like starting with this list of 400, I can imagine that because you've done animal work for a few years now, like 5 years, maybe quite a few cohorts. So that list doesn't necessarily start from scratch each time. There is like a base list of like, we've been thinking about these ideas. We weren't sure if it was the right time, like 5 years ago, but actually maybe now that, you know, animal advocacy is coming to the forefront a little. Is that right, that the list is kind of maybe constantly developing rather than starting from scratch each time?
Yeah, it's definitely constantly developing. We do revisit some ideas that we looked into in the past, like, for example, ideas that we had, there was not enough evidence, for example, to think that this is going to be effective. And maybe in the meantime, the evidence has been generated, either proven to be, you know, working or not. And then we update our reviews every year about those issues. But also you'll be surprised how often new ideas come up to the table as well when we kind of like brainstorm from scratch. So of course, we use the old list to see whether any of the ideas are worth rethinking, but we often also kind of come up with completely new ideas. Sometimes we also shift kind of like ways of thinking, or like almost think from a different perspective or different theory of change, see whether that brings new ideas into the table. Like, for example, you know, in the past, I think the ideas have been tilted toward ideas that improve welfare of animals that are farmed on large scale, like farm fish or farm shrimp. This year, we looked into more a little bit in the kind of like preventative frame, I guess. So kind of like looking at what could be the problems that will likely be developed in factory farm animals that are currently not large scale problems, but might become or will likely become big problems in the future. And that's kind of when the consideration of insect farming came to mind. Insects are farmed on a very large scale, but it's likely gonna, it might take up more and be a larger problem in the future. So is there something that we could do right now that will prevent from this problem from growing instead of trying to shrink the big problem that already exists?
And you mentioned there in terms of sometimes there won't be enough evidence to like really recommend or really prioritize a certain intervention. And I guess I wanted to drill down on this idea of how you guys think about evidence and how much weight you put on this, because I think maybe we spoke about it in our first episode with Dave, Cohen, and Heidi, in terms of just maybe the animal space doesn't have that much information relative to global health in terms of what works and what doesn't. So I guess what are your thoughts on how important evidence is, and to what extent do you think we should be using as high of a bar as global health, or we should need to change our bar accordingly?
I think if we were using the same bar in global health, we wouldn't start almost any organizations. So, of course, we cannot use the same bar. The evidence, you know, we don't have the luxury of the amount of evidence that exists in global health and poverty. And also sometimes that frame of mind might make us miss some of the ideas. So it's not like a restrictive thing that will keep us not from recommending charity, although we do strive for the interventions to have the most evidence behind them as possible. So that could be either evidence behind the effectiveness of the, let's say, called tactic we are using, let's say political advocacy or corporate campaigns or farmer level work, whatever that would be, or individual outreach, or it could be evidence behind the intervention or change for animal itself, like how much evidence there is that if we move hens from a cage system to cage free, their welfare is going to be much better, like how much evidence there is behind that claim. So when we think about evidence, we think about evidence at almost like each step in the theory of change. So you know, how much evidence there is that we're going to make this change? What's the probability of success? How much the evidence there is that it's going to actually improve the conditions on the farms, and how much evidence there actually is that once the condition be improved, the welfare of animals will be better. And we try to assess the evidence behind kind of all of those steps in the theory of change.
Is that the same process for something a bit more meta, like animal advocacy careers? What's the theory of change there? Because I can imagine that's really hard to assess, because I can't imagine there's much research at all on that kind of high level stuff.
Exactly. Speaking to the trade-off, James, I think with animal advocacy careers, we looked into this, and sometimes we do this well, right? Sometimes there's no evidence behind some of the things are seem to be worth doing, but it's worth doing them nevertheless. And then what we do is we not only start organization doing that, but we put very strong focus on that kind of monitoring and evaluation and research being integral part of the organization. So Animal Advocacy Careers, when it started, the aim was not just to help people transition into career, full-time careers in a farm animal welfare advocacy, but it also to measure and evaluate effectiveness of different strategies to bring in people to the movement. So kind of monitoring and evaluation was the very heart of the organization from the beginning. And whenever they run a new program, let's say they run, they have a headhunting program. They had a online course. They had a one-on-one coaching, and they put a lot of effort into evaluating how effective it actually is in bringing in people to the movement. So if there's intervention that don't have enough evidence behind them, but it's still from like kind of perspective of if it works, then it's going to be super impactful. Mm. If you kind of take this frame of mind, we still might recommend this organization, but then recommend very strong monitoring, evaluation, and research to be integrated into their work. And that's kind of what happened with Animal Advocacy Careers. And I think they, since then, they generated a lot of knowledge about how to build a movement, how to bring in people to work full-time on animal careers.
What are some ways do you think your research process is like limited? Or is there any times when, I don't know, to what extent, if you like, your gut feeling is like, wow, no, this idea is so good, but then for some reason it doesn't make it to the top cut. And like, how are you balanced thinking, oh, you should change the process versus actually our gut feeling was initially wrong and yeah, those were the intentions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess we change the process every year. In a way, we run like a... It's not going to sound super nerdy, but like we run research process on our research process, if it makes sense. So we basically like every year evaluate the effectiveness of our process, like how many ideas do we think we missed? You know, can we make this process more efficient? Do we actually have to spend, you know, 100 hours conducting cost effectiveness analysis that is a very integral part of our process? Or is it enough to do like a quicker, you know, 50 hours cost effectiveness analysis or something like this? So we kind of like try to evaluate the kind of like efficiency and effectiveness of the process itself. We also make predictions at the very beginning. When we have the long list of ideas, we make predictions without doing research. Which ideas do we think might end up being recommended by the end of the research process? We kind of basically put them on the side, forget about them, run the research process objectively and all of this, and then look back at the predictions we made. And what we've seen is that a lot of ideas can be predicted ahead of time, but there will be one, at least one idea that was completely surprising. We did not expect it to make to the list. So I can give you an example from the very first year, you know, recommending someone working on fish welfare. Seemed pretty obvious from the beginning, large scale problem. At the time, there was no one working on fish welfare organization. So very neglected problem, large scale of the problem. Quite centralized, few countries are responsible for majority of the production. So if we tackle the problem there, that could be very effective, large scale from the beginning. All of those reasons seem kind of compelling that it might be recommended. But there were some others that were very surprising to us. And I think feed fortification was one of those very surprising ones. That was just like a kind of like random crazy idea we came up with. Fortifying food in global health is like a very effective intervention. So we kind of thought, is there any reason why it might also be very effective and cost effective in animal space. And I was researching one of the sources of pain in egg-laying hens. And what was very striking to me is that kneel bone fractures turn out to be a very large problem in egg-laying hens and something I've never heard about, even though I've been an activist for a long time. I just didn't know that this is such a large problem where majority of the hens do suffer from bone fractures. So that made me dive deeper into this issue. Found out that actually there's a lot of evidence that adding vital micronutrients like vitamin D3 or calcium to feed of hens prevents bone fractures from happening and therefore significantly reduces pain of hens in those systems. And that felt very surprising to me, very shocking to me, to the level where I doubt myself like million times whether it actually makes sense. Seriously, I was so close not to believing that I found something that other people haven't thought about, that I was thinking about dropping this idea, but fortunately I had some support not to get too anxious about it. But and you know, it did later research did confirm that bone fractures is, I believe, in cage-free systems, is the largest source of pain in egg-laying hens. So there was not as many research back then about that, but it did seem to be research enough that I think that was true. And just the amount of evidence we found behind feed fortification as intervention, that was probably the most evidence-based intervention we have researched, the one that has most academic evidence about. So we were quite surprised about that. So as you can see, like, sometimes some of them are quite obvious, and research process is mostly kind of like to gain more information, find the leverage, all of those sort of things. And other ones are just very surprising. So I don't think we would get away without using like the whole research process. But we do improve it every year to make it more effective and efficient.
So actually, that charity did launch, Help Your Hens, was doing feed fortification, or is doing feed fortification, I think primarily based in Kenya. They've kind of struggled a bit, at least to get funding and take off the ground and implement their program in the way they wanted to. And why do you think that was, given if you thought actually they had some of the strongest evidence base for their work, but you think they maybe didn't do as well as they could have, or they like was it predicted to?
Yeah, I think that's tough. I think sometimes you might have interventions that have a lot of evidence behind. So that's kind of what I mentioned. Like, when we look at evidence, we both look at the evidence behind the ask, or what we are hoping to change, practice we are hoping for change, as well as the evidence behind the tactic or the strategy. And in this case, there was lots of evidence about the ask, like how effective would feed fortification would be, and much less evidence about how to bring on this change. And I think kind of that's what, when it's much trickier, kind of like finding this leverage for change, finding a tactic and strategy that will work. They work in quite complex industry. They also chose a country that I think is particularly tricky to work with. They're working in Kenya, a country that without large movement, without lots of proven tactics, definitely not the same way as in Europe or US, where we kind of like know some tactics working, and quite complex environment. So I think kind of like that maybe made it much more tricky for them to make progress.
A question I get asked a lot when I talk about being involved with charity entrepreneurship and the work that you do is the decision to launch new organizations every time, and not necessarily just projects within existing organizations, or launching it as a project rather than starting up as a full-blown kind of organization. Why is it that you think within the program that is the focus?
Yeah. I think there are a couple of like popular ways of thinking. Like, one is like, there's enough organizations, they just need more funding, which I think, yes, that's true. The organization needs more funding and they're doing amazing work and they should be funded more, and there should be more money in animal advocacy space for sure. Or like that there is one organization can tackle all the problems in a given country, or we should take one big organization and scale it to multiple countries. I think they're kind of like different ways of thinking about that. And I think, again, they're not excluding themselves. I do agree there should be more funding going to existing organizations. I do agree organizations should scale well. And I do agree there should be strong organizations in many countries. But I think there is enough gaps that are completely not filled by new organizations, or won't be able to be filled by new organizations anytime soon, that starting an organization makes a lot of sense. I don't know when would be the time when some of the existing organizations would move on to working on shrimp welfare issues in Vietnam, Ecuador, Indonesia.
Yeah,
right. Might not be very long time. Like, it might be very, very, very long time. And so delaying starting shrimp welfare project would have been a very big mistake, given how much progress they made very, very fast within, you know, the first years of existing. They already helped millions of like hundreds of millions of shrimps, really. And that would just not happen if we waited for some of the existing organization to step in and start working on this problem. And unfortunately, given the scale of the fact of factory farming and problems for farmed animals, you know, existing organizations, however amazing job they could be doing, they are still drop in the bucket compared to the scale of the problem. And I think because there are so many gaps that exist in the space, there is a space for new organizations working on those issues as well. So I think that's the kind of like the crucial reason why we think starting your organization is like a strong way to have an impact. There are other considerations as well, but I'm not sure how much to get into them. But I think that's kind of the main piece, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And what are your sort of main concerns with launching new organizations? As you were saying, like funding is fairly limited, so it's making like the competition particularly fierce within the space. Also maybe taking this kind of like within EA, like a sense of people could be earning to give. So there's this sense of taking people away from high impact roles, maybe even within existing organizations, like taking them out and putting them in starting a charity or taking someone out of the private sector where they could be earning to give. Are there any other senses of what the biggest sort of concerns are from charity entrepreneurship with launching new organizations?
I do think that there's lots of barriers for starting new charities. And I think because those concerns about launching new organization exist, so few people still decide to go down this pathway. And I think sometimes they're very legitimate and they make a lot of sense and we include them into our decision making. And sometimes they're mostly kind of things that relate to uncertainty and could be addressed and with support structures. So I guess about those kind of biggest concerns with launching an organization, I think the common one is funding, whether this organization will be able to either raise enough funding to operate themselves, or would it take away funding from more effective organizations or kind of creating this competitive field to some extent? I think that's a common worry, or like one of the first questions people ask us about. And I guess that's why we also look into something that I already mentioned, like which is like limiting factor. Is funding likely to be a limiting factor for this organization and in the field overall or not? Because sometimes people think about funding as like a zero-sum game. If you gain funding, someone else loses it. But sometimes I just don't think that that's how it works. Sometimes it might increase the pie instead of just dividing it differently. For example, maybe a funder who is interested in funding shrimp project is not going to be a funder that will be interested for funding, I don't know, organizations focusing on different, not as non-conventional animals, I guess. So sometimes it might be that organization will increase the funding pool overall, especially with the organizations we recommended this year. I'm going to speak about it a little bit later, but I think that's a kind of common concern people have. And whenever we decide to start a charity, we also ask ourselves a question whether this funding will be a limitation for this organization or whether that will impact funding in a negative way for other organizations as well. I also sometimes think that like just more organizations is better in a way that that puts a really healthy kind of like healthy dynamic where we are all striving to have the highest impact possible. Of course, it can get wrong. If like some organizations are better at fundraising, but are actually not bringing results and those sort of things, of course, those dynamics exist. We should be cognizant of them. But in general, I think having more impact-focused organizations striving to have more impact just generally have like a good effect on the ecosystem as well. On the concerns of talent taking that you mentioned, Amy, again, we have kind of like a policy. I know it's very untypical, but we have like a policy in our recruitment strategy that we are not doing any poaching. Like basically we would not, if someone is in like a very high impact role already, we would not reach out to them, say, hey, drop your job, join us to do this new thing. Just because we think, we are cognizant of counterfactual impact. We know that people who would join the program otherwise will be doing very impactful things because they're, highly talented, motivated and all of this. So we try to be cognizant of their other options as well. Of course, different situation if the person just applies to the program, then that's a completely choice, but we do take that into account. Something we also do is whenever we run our cost effectiveness analysis, so this is how many animals will this organization help per dollar spent, we take into account the so-called contractual cost of a co-founder. What I mean by that is every person that goes to program most likely will have some impact on animals, even if they, with their different alternative career path. So we try to discount the effect of starting new organizations by the value of their other potential job. So we try to take into account those effects, and only after passing those kind of rigorous bar for effectiveness, we decide to launch a new charity. So we take into account counterfactuals of funding or counterfactuals of talent, all sort of things. And only after passing that bar, we are recommending something. So we do try to take it into account.
It's interesting you mentioned about the new organizations. I was talking to Haven at the AVA conference, who says his concern is that people go, oh, Fish Welfare Initiative exists. Like, no one else needs to work on fish now because their organization exists. And actually, of course, like, we could benefit from like 100 fish welfare initiatives and it still wouldn't be enough, like working on the topic of fish. So, yeah, I think just thinking about it in that sense that people are concerned and would back off because they, you know, they've got fish under control is like, when you think about the numbers is actually obviously like an effective route to helping them, really.
Yeah, exactly. Or just even thinking, you know, oh, there is like, there are two organizations, I'm not saying this is true, but like there are two organizations working in X country on farm and welfare. Clearly they have the whole country covered, even if the country is India, that is as large as, you know, the whole Europe. Obviously saying, oh, there's two organizations in Europe, don't worry about farming and welfare there would be a silly thing to say. And often we might say about something about this, about bigger countries as well. So again, there's just so many gaps to be filled. And I see the sentiment among CE incubatees that, you know, often we might ask organizations, hey, I want to work on this thing. What do you think? If they're, okay, scratch it. I'm not going to say this. Scratch that.
Okay. Yeah, because maybe like one idea to think of is like what you're actually interested in is like kind of like what impact will this additional group have on the margin? And like even if a group has, even if a space has groups in it already, doesn't mean there's like no more avenues to do good work in that field. So like there's clearly, certain niches that you might be well placed to fit.
Exactly. And sometimes even like having more organizations working on the same issues seems effective as well. I remember we ran like an analysis on corporate campaigns where we tried to analyze whether additional group working on corporate campaign actually have like a significant impact on the margin, as you're saying. And because our prior view was that, you know, if there's already an organization working on corporate campaigns in country X, that probably doesn't make sense to have another one working on corporate campaigns in the same country. And we ran analysis, and actually the number of commitments correlates with number of organizations that are in the country in a way that still makes them cost effective, which was kind of surprising to us. So it even shows that it is worth often having more than one organization, especially if you can, you know, have different tactics. One will be like the good cop, the other one will be the bad cop, and all of this. So there's just so much more nuance in the space, and I think that just shows the importance like of researching the ideas very well instead of just going off our intuitions here.
Yeah, nice, makes a lot of sense. Cool. Great. Well, thanks so much, Carolina. I feel like that's been, very interesting, very jam-packed with really interesting insights into the charity entrepreneurship process. And just in closing then, I'm interested to hear if you have any news that you're excited about recently.
Yeah, I guess I think the legislative changes on the EU level and elsewhere as well is just something that is absolutely thrilling to me. Just seeing, you know, all this hard work of people working on corporate campaigns being now possibly turned into a policy that's going to lock this in for an foreseeable future. That just absolutely amazing thing to see. And this is what we should be striving for. So very excited about that. And just more broadly, I see kind of policy work as very important part of our theory, a long-term theory of change. And we're also very excited about starting organizations that are focusing on policy and just seeing that level of support, sometimes very surprising. It's just amazing to see. Just a very quick news from one of the charities we incubated, Animal Policy International, working in New Zealand, recently ran a poll to see how much support there is for banning low welfare imports to New Zealand from other countries that have lower standards than New Zealand. And about 83% of people support that ban, which is much, much more than we even expected. And there was no, you know, tweaking the questions or anything like this. So very, very big support for that. They even got onto Green Party official manifesto, which is very important before, you know, the upcoming election in New Zealand. So we see a lot of progress on that. So I do believe policy change is something that is very feasible to do for animals and could have long, big lasting impact. So very excited about all of that happening.
Great. Nice one.
Yeah, that was very impressive given they only started like not that long ago. So OECD implementing.
Yeah, it's been like a couple of months. It's crazy.
Yeah. Very impressive. And in terms of some media recommendations you'd give to listeners to either hear about the kind of stuff you spoke about today or broadly your views, what would you recommend to people?
super boring. This podcast is great. I'm a big fan. Highly recommend it. So for sure. I think maybe outside of that, signing up to Lewis Bullard's newsletter now, I believe it's a Substack. I think great source of high level overview about so many different tactics we used in the movement. So great source of knowledge. I guess maybe less conventional would be a book by Douglas Hubbard, How to Measure Anything. Again, it comes down to these questions of, you know, if we're having meaningful change, if it's meaningful, then it can be observed. If it can be observed, it can be measured. And by measuring it, we not only can improve effectiveness of our actions, but also can bring new information to the whole movement that the whole movement can benefit from. So just importance of showing the importance of measurement, and that more things can be measured than we expect. And I think that's having that sort of thing in your mind is very helpful whenever you're thinking about planning campaign or evaluating campaign, or just generally help producing something that'll be helpful to the movement. So highly recommend it as well.
Great. Yeah, in terms of people getting involved in your work, we've got the incubation program deadline on the 30th of September. That's for the February-March intake. James and I would both encourage, anyone interested to apply and also talk to us about it more if anyone's kind of on the fence.
Absolutely. I also just want to add that our team is also very keen to speak with anyone who's interested in that. So if you have any questions or have any doubts or just anything you want to talk about, feel free to just contact us either for our contact form or message someone from our recruitment team.
Great. I'll put all of that in the show notes as well.
That's very helpful and kind of you. Cool. Is there anything else you want to say before we close up in terms of how ways people get engaged with your work or follow you or follow the Animal Welfare Fund, or yeah?
Sure. I mean, definitely follow us. You can sign up to our newsletter to get stay up to date, not only with CE, but also what our charities are up to. You can see all of the charities we incubated listed on our website. So if you're curious about any of their work, feel free to check them out. They also have contact information there as well. So I not only recommend, you know, checking out CE as well, whether co-founding is an option for you, but if you also want to get engaged with any other organizations we incubated, you can find all of them on our website. So I recommend checking them out as well. That'll be it.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Caroline. This has been super, super exciting. Yeah, obviously we're big fans of the work, and I think there's been already a few people from the CE program on the show. I'm sure there'll be many more in the future as well. So yeah, thank you for all your amazing work.
And thank you for yours likewise as well, James. Thanks, Amy.